He took me by the shoulder as he spoke, and we began to walk down one of the long, narrow paths between the towering bookcases. Sibe followed us, holding up his candelabrum. I suppose more for his benefit than mine, but it permitted me to see well enough to keep from colliding with the dark oak shelves we passed.
"Your eyes have not yet failed you," Master Ultan said after a time. "Do you apprehend any termination to this isle?"
"No, sir," I said, and in fact, I did not. As far as the candlelight flew, there was only row upon row of books, stretching from the floor to the high ceiling. Some of the shelves were disordered, some straight. Once or twice I saw evidence that rats had been nesting among the books, rearranging them to make snug 2- and 3-level homes for themselves, and smearing dung on the covers to form the rude characters of their speech. But always there were books and more books, rows of spines and calf, morocco, binder's cloth, paper, and 100 other substances I could not identify, some flashing with gilt, many lettered in black, a few with paper labels so old and yellowed that they were as brown as dead leaves.
"Of the trail of ink there is no end," Master Ultan told me.
"Or so a wise man said. He lived long ago. What would he say if he could see us now?"
Another said, "A man will give his life to the turning over of a collection of books. But I would like to meet the man who could turn over this one on any topic."
"I was looking at the bindings," I answered, feeling rather foolish.
"How fortunate for you. Yet I am glad. I can no longer see them. But I remember the pleasure I once had in doing it. That would be just after I had become master librarian. I suppose I was about 50. I had, you know, been an apprentice for many, many years."
"Is that so, sir?"
"Indeed it is. My master was Gerbold, and for decades it appeared that he would never die. Year followed, straggling year for me, and all that time I read. I suppose few have ever read so. I began, as most young people do, by reading the books I enjoyed, but I found that narrowed my pleasure in time, until I spent most of my hours searching for such books. Then I devised a plan of study for myself, tracing obscure sciences, one after another, from the dawn of knowledge to the present. Eventually I exhausted even that, and beginning at the great ebony case that stands in the center of the room we of the library have maintained for 300 years against the return of the autarch Sulpicius, and into which in consequence no one ever comes, I read outward for a period of 15 years, often finishing 2 books in one day."
Behind us, Sibe murmured, "Marvelous, sir." I suspected that he had heard the story many times.
"Then the unlooked-for seized me by the coat. Master Gerbold died. 30 years before, I had been ideally suited by reason of predilection, education, experience, youth, family connections, and ambition to succeed him. At the time I actually did so, no one could have been less fit. I had waited so long that waiting was all I understood. And I possessed a mind suffocated beneath the weight of inutile facts. But I forced myself to take charge, and spent more hours than I could expect you to believe now in attempting to recall the plans and maxims I had laid down so many years ago for my eventual succession."
He paused, and I knew he was delving again in a mind larger and darker than even his great library. But my old habit of reading dogged me still. I lost to books days and even weeks
during which I should have been considering the operations of the establishment that looked to me for leadership. Then, as suddenly as the striking of a clock, a new passion came to me, displacing the old. You will already have guessed what it was. I told him I had not. I was reading, or so I thought, on the seat of that bow window on the 49th floor that overlooks, I have forgotten, Sibe, what is it that it overlooks?
The upholsterer's garden, sir.
Yes, I recall it now, that little square of green and brown. I believe they dry rosemary there to put in pillows. I was sitting there, as I said, and had been for several watches, when it came to me that I was reading no longer. For some time I was hard put to say what I had been doing. When I tried, I could only think of certain odors and textures and colors that seemed to have no connection with anything discussed in the volume I held. At last I realized that instead of reading it, I had been observing it as a physical object. The red, I recalled, came from the ribbon sewn to the headband so that I might mark my place. The texture that tickled my fingers still was that of the paper on which the book was printed. The smell in my nostrils was old leather, still bearing the traces of birch oil. It was only then, when I saw the books themselves, that I began to understand their care. His grip on my shoulder tightened. We have books here bound in the hides of echidnas, krakens, and beasts so long extinct that those who study as they are for the most part of the opinion that no trace of them survives unfossilized. We have books bound wholly in metals of unknown alloy, and books whose bindings are covered with thick-set gems. We have books cased in perfumed woods, shipped across the inconceivable gulf between creations. Books doubly precious, because no one on earth can read them. We have books whose papers are matted of plants from which spring curious alkaloids, so that the reader, in turning their pages, is taken unaware by bizarre fantasies and chimeric dreams. Books whose pages are not paper at all, but delicate wafers of white jade, ivory, and shell. Books, too, whose leaves are the desiccated leaves of unknown plants. Books we have also that are not books at all to the eye. Scrolls and tablets and recordings on 100 different substances. There is a cube of crystal here, though I can no longer tell you where, no larger than the ball of your thumb, that contains more books than the library itself does. Though a harlot might dangle it from one ear for an ornament, there are not volumes enough in the world to counterweight the other. All these I came to know, and I made safeguarding them my life's devotion. For 7 years I busied myself with that, and then, just when the pressing and superficial problems of preservation were disposed of, and we were on the point of beginning the first general survey of the library since its foundation, my eyes began to gutter in their sockets. He who had given all books into my keeping made me blind, so that I should know in whose keeping the keepers stand. "If you can't read the letter I brought, sir," I said, "I will be glad to read it to you."
"You are right," Master Oltan muttered. "I had forgotten it. Sibe will read it. He reads well. Here, Sibe."
I held the candelabrum for him, and Sibe unfolded the crackling parchment, held it up like a proclamation, and began to read, the three of us standing in a little circle of candlelight, while all the books crowded around.
"From Master Gerlose of the Order of the Seekers for Truth and Penitence."
"What?" said Master Ultan. Are you a torturer, young man?
I told him I was, and there occurred a silence so long that Saibi began to read the letter a second time. From Master Gerlos of the Order of the Seekers,
wait,
Ultan said. Saibi paused again. I stood as I had, holding the light and feeling the blood mounting to my cheeks. At last, Master Ultan spoke again, and his voice was as matter-of-fact as it had been in telling me Saibi Redwell.
I can hardly recall my own admission to our guild. You are familiar, I suppose, with the method by which we recruit our numbers.
I admitted I was not.
In every library, by ancient precept, is a room reserved for children. In it are kept bright picture books, such as children delight in, and a few simple tales of wonder and adventure. Many children come to these rooms, and so long as they remain within their confines, no interest is taken in them.
He hesitated, and though I could discern no expression on his face, I received the impression that he feared what he was about to say might cause Saibi pain.
From time to time, however, a librarian remarks a solitary child, still of tender years, who wanders from the children's room, and at last deserts it entirely. Such a child eventually discovers, on some low but obscure shelf, the Book of Gold. You have never seen this book, and you will never see it, being past the age at which it is met.
It must be very beautiful, I said.
It is indeed. Unless my memory betrays me, the cover is of black buckram, considerably faded at the spine. Several of the signatures are coming out, and certain of the plates have been taken. But it is a remarkably lovely book. I wish that I might find it again, though all books are shut to me now. The child, as I said, in time discovers the Book of Gold. Then the librarians come, like vampires, some say, but others say like the fairy godparents at a christening. They speak to the child, and the child joins them. Henceforth, he is in the library, wherever he may be, and soon his parents know him no more. I suppose it is much the same among the torturers.
We take such children as fall into our hands, I said, and are very young.
We do the same, old Ultan muttered. So we have little right to condemn you. Read on, Saibi. From Master Gerlos of the Order of the Seekers for Truth and Penitence to the Archivist of the Citadel. Greetings, brother. By the will of a court, we have in our keeping the exalted person of the Chatelaine Thecla, and by its further will, we would furnish to the Chatelaine Thecla, and by its further will, we would furnish to the Chatelaine Thecla in her confinement such comforts as lie not beyond reason and prudence, that she may while away the moments until her time with us is come, or rather, as she has instructed me to say, until the heart of the Autarch, whose forbearance knows not walls nor seas, is softened toward her as she prays. She asks that you, consonant with your office, provide her with certain books. Which books are—
You may omit the titles, Saibi, Ultan said. How many are there?
Forcia. No trouble, then. Proceed. For this, Archivist, we are much obligated to you. Signed, Gerlos, Master of the Honorable Order, commonly called the Guild of Torturers.
Are you familiar with any of the titles on Master Gerlos's list, Saibi?
With three, sir.
Very good. Fetch them, please. What is the fourth?
The Book of the Wonders of Earth and Sky, sir.
Better and better. There is a copy not 2 chains from here. When you have your volumes, you may meet us at the door through which this young man, whom I fear we have already detained too long, entered the stacks.
I attempted to return the candelabrum to Saibi,
but he indicated by a sign that I was to keep it, and trotted off down a narrow aisle. Old Tan was stalking away in the opposite direction, moving as surely as if he possessed vision. "I recollect it well," he said. "The binding is of brown cordwain. All edges are gilt, and there are etchings by Gwinnock, hand-tinted. It is on the third shelf from the floor, and leans against a folio in green cloth. I believe it is Blaythe Makes Lives of the 17 Megatherians." Largely to let him know I had not left him, though no doubt his sharp ears caught my footfalls behind him, I asked, "What is it, sir? The Earth and Sky book, I mean." "Why," he said, "don't you know better than to ask that question of a librarian? Our concern, young man, is with the books themselves, not with their contents." I caught the amusement in his tone. "I think you know the contents of every book here, sir." "Hardly. But Wonders of Earth and Sky was a standard work, 300 or 400 years ago. It relates most of the familiar legends of ancient times. To me, the most interesting is that of the historians, which tells of a time in which every legend could be traced to half-forgotten fact. You see the paradox, I assume. Did that legend itself exist at that time? And if not, how came it into existence?" "Aren't there any great serpents, sir, or flying women?"
"Oh, yes,"
Master Oltan answered, stooping as he spoke.
"But not in the legend of the historians."
Triumphantly, he held up a small volume bound in flaking leather.
"Have a look at this, young man, and see if I've got the right one."
I had to set the candelabrum on the floor and crouch beside it. The book in my hands was so old and stiff and musty that it seemed impossible that it had been opened within the past century. But the title page confirmed the old man's boast. A subtitle announced, "Being a collection from printed sources of universal secrets of such age that their meaning has become obscured of time."
"Well,"
asked Master Oltan,
"was I right or no?"
I opened the book at random and read, "By which means a picture might be graven with such skill that the whole of it, should it be destroyed, might be recreated from a small part, and that small part might be any part." I suppose it was the word graven that suggested to me the events I had witnessed on the night I had received my Chrysos. "Master," I answered, "you are phenomenal."
"No, but I am seldom mistaken."
"You, of all men, will excuse me when I tell you I tarried a moment to read a few lines of this book. Master, you know of the corpse-eaters, surely. I have heard it said that by devouring the flesh of the dead, together with a certain pharmacon, they are able to relive the lives of their victims."
"It is unwise to know too much about these practices,"
the archivist murmured.
"Though when I think of sharing the mind of a historian like Lohmann or Hermas..."
In his years of blindness, he must have forgotten how nakedly our faces can betray our deepest feelings. By the light of the candles, I saw his twisted in such an agony of desire that out of decency I turned away. His voice remained as calm as some solemn bell. "But from what I once read, you are correct, though I do not now recall that the book you hold treats of it." "Master," I said, "I give you my word I would never suspect you of such a thing. But tell me this. Suppose two collaborate in the robbing of a grave, and one takes the right hand for his share and the other the left. Does he who ate the right hand have but half the dead man's life, and the other the rest? And if so, what if a third were to come and devour a foot?"
"It's a pity you are a torturer,"
Oltan said.
"You might have been a philosopher."
No, as I understand this noxious matter, each has the entire life. Then a man's whole life is in his right hand and in his left as well. Is it in each finger too? I believe each participant must consume more than a mouthful for the practice to be effective.
But I suppose that in theory, at least, what you say is correct. The entire life is in each finger.
We were already walking back in the direction we had come. Since the aisle was too narrow for us to pass one another, I now carried the candelabrum before him, and a stranger, seeing us, would surely have thought I lighted his way.
"But, Master," I said, "how can that be?"
"By the same argument, the life must reside in each joint of every finger, and surely that is impossible."
"How big is a man's life?" asked Oltan.
"I have no way of knowing, but isn't it larger than that?"
"You see it from the beginning, and anticipate much. I, recollecting it from its termination, know how little there has been. I suppose that is why the depraved creatures who devour the bodies of the dead seek more. Let me ask you this. Are you aware that a son often strikingly resembles his father?"
"I have heard it said, yes, and I believe it," I answered. I could not help thinking, as I did, of the parents I would never know.
"Then it is possible you will agree, since each son may resemble his father, for a face to endure through many generations. That is, if the son resembles the father, and his son resembles him, and that son's son resembles him, then the fourth in line, the great-grandson, resembles his great-grandfather."
"Yes," I said.
"Yet the seed of all of them was contained in a dram of sticky fluid. If they did not come from there, from where did they come?"
I could make no answer to that, and walked along in puzzlement, until we reached the door through which I had entered this lowest level of the great library. Here we met Saibi carrying the other books mentioned in Master Gurlose's letter. I took them from him, bade goodbye to Master Oltan, and very gratefully left the stifling atmosphere of the library stacks. To the upper levels of that place I returned several times, but I never again entered that tomb-like cellar, or ever wished to. One of the three volumes Saibi had brought was as large as the top of a small table, a cubit in width, and a scant ell in height. From the arms impressed upon its Saffian cover, I supposed it to be the history of some old noble family. The others were much smaller. A green book, hardly larger than my hand and no thicker than my index finger, appeared to be a collection of devotions full of enameled pictures of ascetic pantocrators and hypostases with black halos and gem-like robes. I stopped for a time to look at them, sharing a little forgotten garden full of winter sunshine with a dry fountain. Before I had so much as opened any of the other volumes, I felt that pressure of time that is perhaps the surest indication we have left childhood behind. I had already been 2 watches at least on a simple errand, and soon the light would fade. I gathered up the books and hurried along, though I did not know it, to meet my destiny, and eventually myself in the Chatelaine Thecla. Chapter 7 The Traitress. It was already time for me to carry their meals to the journeymen on duty in the oubliette. Draught was in charge of the first level, and I brought his last because I wanted to talk to him before I went up again. The truth was that my head was still swimming with thoughts engendered by my visit to the archivist, and I wanted to tell him about them. He was nowhere to be seen.
I put his tray and the four books on his table and shouted for him. A moment later, I heard his answering call from a cell not far off. I ran there and looked through the grilled windows set at eye level in the door. The client, a wasted-looking woman of middle age, was stretched on her cot. Draught leaned over her, and there was blood on the floor. He was too occupied to turn his head.
"Is that you, Severian?"
"Yes, I've got your supper and books for the Chatelaine Thecla. Can I do anything to help?"
"She'll be all right. Tore her dressings off and tried to bleed herself to death, but I got her in time."
"Leave my tray on the table, will you? And you might finish shoving their food at the rest for me, if you've got a moment." I hesitated. Apprentices were not supposed to deal with those committed to the guild's care.
"Go ahead, all you have to do is poke the trays through the slots."
"I brought the books. Poke those through the slot, too." For a moment more, I watched him as he bent over the livid woman on the cot. Then I turned away, found the undistributed trays, and began to do as he had asked. Most of the clients in the cells were still strong enough to rise and take the food as I passed it through. A few were not, and I left their trays outside their doors for Draught to carry in later. There were several aristocratic-looking women, but none who seemed likely to be the Chatelaine Thecla, a newly come exultant who was, at least for the time being, to be treated with deference. As I should have guessed, she was in the last cell. It had been furnished with a carpet, in addition to the usual bed, chair, and small table. In place of the customary rags, she wore a white gown with wide sleeves. The ends of those sleeves and the hem of the skirt were sadly soiled now, but the gown still preserved an air of elegance, as foreign to me as it was to the cell itself. When I first saw her, she was embroidering by the light of a candle, brightened by a silver reflector. But she must have felt my eyes upon her. It would gratify me now to say there was no fear in her face. Yet it would not be true. There was terror there, though controlled nearly to invisibility. "It's all right," I said. "I've brought your food." She nodded and thanked me, then rose and came to the door. She was taller even than I had expected, nearly too tall to stand upright in the cell. Her face, though it was triangular rather than heart-shaped, reminded me of the woman who had been with Vodalus in the necropolis. Perhaps it was her great violet eyes, with their lids shaded with blue, and the black hair that, forming a V far down her forehead, suggested the hood of a cloak. Whatever the reason, I loved her at once. Loved her, at least, insofar as a stupid boy can love. But being only a stupid boy, I did not know it. Her white hand, cold, slightly damp, and impossibly narrow, touched mine as she took the tray from me. "That's ordinary food," I told her. "I think you can get some that's better if you ask." "You're not wearing a mask," she said. "Yours is the first human face I've seen here. I'm only an apprentice. I won't be masked until next year." She smiled, and I felt as I had when I had been in the atrium of time and had come inside to a warm room and food. She had narrow, very white teeth in a wide mouth, her eyes, each as deep as the cistern beneath the bellkeep, shone when she smiled. "I'm sorry," I said. "I didn't hear you." The smile came again, and she tilted her lovely head to one side. "I told you how happy I was to see your face, and asked if you would bring my meals in the future, and what this was you brought me." "No, no, I won't be. Only today, because Draught is occupied." I tried to recall what her meal had been. She had put the tray on her little table, where I could not see its contents through the grill. I could not, though I nearly burst my brain with the effort. At last I said, lamely, "You'd probably better eat it. But I think you can get better food if you ask Drott." "Why, I intend to eat it. People have always complimented me on my slender figure, but believe me, I eat like a dire wolf." She picked up the tray and held it out to me, as though she knew I would need every help in unraveling the mystery of its contents. "Those are leeks, Chatelaine," I said. "Those green things. The brown ones are lentils, and that's bread." "Chatelaine, you needn't be so formal. You're my jailer, and can call me anything you choose." There was merriment in the deep eyes now. "I have no wish to insult you," I told her. "Would you rather I called you something else?" "Call me Thecla. That's my name. Titles are for formal occasions, names for informal ones, and this is that or nothing. I suppose it will be very formal, though, when I receive my punishment." "It is usually for exultance." "There will be an exarch, I should think, if you will let him in, all in scarlet patches. Several others, too. Perhaps the Starost Egino. Are you certain this is bread?" She poked it with one long finger, so white I thought for a moment that the bread might soil it. "Yes," I said. "The Chatelaine has eaten bread before, surely." "Not like this." She picked the meager slice up and tore it with her teeth, quickly and cleanly. "It isn't bad, though. You say they'll bring me better food if I ask for it?"
"I think so, Chatelaine."
"Thecla, I asked for books 2 days ago when I came, but I haven't got them."
"I have them," I told her.
"Right here." I ran back to Drott's table and got them and passed the smallest through the slot.
"Oh, wonderful. Are there others?"
"Three more." The brown book went through the slot as well, but the other two, the green book and the folio volume with arms on its cover, were too wide. "Drott will open your door later and give them to you," I said.
"Can't you? It's terrible to look through this and see them, and not be able to touch them."
"I'm not even supposed to feed you. Drott should do it."
"But you did.
Besides, you brought them. Weren't you supposed to give them to me?" I could argue only weakly, knowing she was right in principle. The rule against apprentices working in the oubliette was intended to prevent escapes, and I knew that tall though she was, this slender woman could never overpower me, and that should she do so, she would have no chance of making her way out without being challenged. I went to the door of the cell where Drott still labored over the client who had tried to take her own life, and returned with his keys. Standing before her, with her own cell door closed and locked behind me, I found myself unable to speak. I put the books on her table beside the candle-stand, and her food pan and carafe of water. There was hardly room for them. When it was done, I stood waiting, knowing I should leave and yet unable to go.
"Won't you sit down?"
I sat on her bed, leaving her the chair.
"If this were my suite and the house absolute, I could offer you better comfort. Unfortunately, you never called while I was there."
I shook my head.
"Here I have no refreshment to offer you but this. Do you like lentils?" "I won't eat that, Chatelaine. I'll have my own supper soon, and there's hardly enough for you."
"True." She picked up a leek, and then, as if she did not know what else to do with it, dropped it down her throat, like a mountebank swallowing a viper.
"What will you have?"
"Leeks and lentils, bread and mutton."
"Ah, the torturers get mutton. That's the difference." What's your name, Master Torturer? Severian. It won't help, Chatelaine. It won't make any difference. She smiled. What won't? Making friends with me. I couldn't give you your freedom. And I wouldn't. Not if I had no friend but you in all the world. I didn't think you could, Severian. Then why do you bother to talk to me? She sighed, and all the gladness went out of her face, as the sunlight leaves the stone where a beggar seeks to warm himself. Who else have I to talk to, Severian? It may be that I will talk to you for a time, for a few days or a few weeks, and die. I know what you're thinking, that if I were back in my suite, I would never spare a glance for you. But you're wrong. One can't talk to everyone because there are so many everyones. But the day before I was taken, I talked for some time with the man who held my mount. I spoke to him because I had to wait, you see. And then he said something that interested me. You won't see me again. Drought will bring your food. And not you. Ask him if he will let you do it. She took my hands in hers, and they were like ice. I'll try, I said. Do. Do try. Tell him I want better meals than this, and you to serve me. Wait, I'll ask him myself. To whom does he answer? Master Gerlows. I'll tell the other, is it Draught, that I want to speak to him? You're right, they'll have to do it. The Autarch might release me. They don't know. Her eyes flashed. I'll tell Draught you want to see him when he's not busy, I said, and stood up. Wait, aren't you going to ask me why I'm here? I know why you're here, I said, as I swung back the door. To be tortured, eventually, like the others. It was a cruel thing to say, and I said it without reflection as young men do, only because it was what was in my mind. Yet it was true, and I was glad in some way as I turned the key in the lock that I had said it. We had had exultance for clients often before. Most, when they arrived, had some understanding of their situation, as the Chatelaine Thecla did now, but when a few days had passed and they were not put to torment, their hope cast down their reason, and they began to talk of release, how friends and family would maneuver to gain their freedom, and of what they would do when they were free. One would withdraw to his estates and trouble the Autarch's court no more. Another would volunteer to lead a muster of lance cadets into the north. Then the journeymen on duty in the oubliette would hear tales of hunting dogs and remote heaths and country games, unknown elsewhere, played beneath the memorial trees. The women were more realistic for the most part, but even they in time spoke of highly placed lovers, cast aside now for months or years, who would never abandon them, and then of bearing children or adopting waifs. One knew when these never-to-be-born children were given names that clothing would not be far behind. A new wardrobe on their release, the old clothes to be burned. They talked of colors, of inventing new fashions and reviving old ones. At last, the time would come, to men and women alike, when instead of a journeyman with food, Master Gerlows would appear trailing three or four journeymen and perhaps an examiner and a fulgurator. I wanted to preserve the Chatelaine Thecla from such hopes, if I could. I hung Draught's keys on their accustomed nail on the wall, and when I passed the cell in which he was now swabbing blood from the floor, told him that the Chatelaine desired to speak with him. On the next day but one, I was summoned to Master Gerlow's. I had expected to stand, as we apprentices usually did, with hands behind back before his table, but he told me to sit, and, removing his gold-traced mask, leaned toward me in a way that implied a common cause and friendly footing.
"A week ago, or a little less, I sent you to the archivist," he said.
I nodded.
"When you brought the books, I take it you delivered them to the client yourself, is that right?"
I explained what had happened.
"Nothing wrong there. I don't want you to think I'm going to order extra fatigues for what you did. Much less have you bent over a chair. You're nearly a journeyman yourself already. When I was your age, they had me cranking the alternator. The thing is, you see, Severian, the client is highly placed."
His voice sank to a rough whisper.
"Quite highly connected."
I said that I understood that.
"Not just an Armiger family. High blood."
He turned and, after searching the disorderly shelves behind his chair, produced a squat book.
"Have you any notion how many exalted families there are? This lists only the ones that are still going. A compendium of the extinguished ones would take an encyclopedia, I suppose. I've extinguished a few of them myself."
He laughed, and I laughed with him.
"It gives about half a page to each. There are 746 pages.
I nodded to show I understood.
"Most of them have nobody at court, can't afford it, or are afraid of it. Those are the small ones. The greater families must. The Autarch wants a concubine he can lay hands on if they start misbehaving. Now, the Autarch can't play quadrille with 500 women. There are maybe 20. The rest talk to each other and dance and don't see him closer than a chain off once in a month."
I asked, trying to hold my voice steady, if the Autarch actually bedded these concubines. Master Gerlose rolled his eyes and pulled at his jaw with one huge hand.
"Well, now, for decency's sake, they have these kybits, what they call the shadow women, that are common girls that look like the chatelaines. I don't know where they get them, but they're supposed to stand in place of the others. Of course, they're not so tall," he chuckled. "I said stand in place, but when they're laying down, the tallness probably doesn't make much difference. They do say, though, that oftentimes it works the other way than it's supposed to. Instead of those shadow girls doing duty for the mistresses do it for them. But the present Autarch, whose every deed, I may say, is sweeter than honey in the mouths of this honorable guild, and don't you forget it, in his case, I may say, from what I understand, it is more than somewhat doubtful if he has the pleasure of any of them."
Relief flooded my heart. "I never knew that. It's very interesting, Master."
Master Gerlose inclined his head to acknowledge that it was indeed, and laced his fingers over his belly. "Some day you may have the ordering of the guild yourself. You'll need to know these things. When I was your age, or a trifle younger, I suppose, I used to fancy I was of exalted blood. Some have been, you know."
It struck me, and not for the first time, that Master Gerlose, and Master Palamon too, must have known whence all the apprentices and younger journeymen had come, having approved their admissions originally.
"Whether I am or no, I cannot say. I have the physique of a rider, I think, and I am somewhat over the average in height despite a hard boyhood. For it was harder, much harder, 40 years ago, I tell you."
"So I have been told, Master." He sighed, the kind of wheezing noise a leather pillow sometimes makes when one sits on it.
But with the passage of time, I have come to understand that the Increate, in choosing for me a career in our guild, was acting for my benefit. Doubtless I had acquired merit in a previous life, as I hope I have in this one.
Master Gerloz fell silent, looking, it seemed to me, at the jumble of papers on his table, the instructions of jurists and the dossiers of clients. At last, when I was about to ask if he had anything further to tell me, he said,
"In all my years, I have never known of a member of the guild put to torment. Of them, several hundred, I suppose."
I ventured the commonplace saying that it was better to be a toad hidden under a stone than a butterfly crushed beneath it.
"We of the guild are more than toads, I think. But I should have added that, though I have seen 500 or more exultants in our cells, I have never, until now, had charge of a member of that inner circle of concubines closest to the Autarch."
"The Chatelaine Thecla belonged to it? You implied that a moment ago, Master."
He nodded gloomily. "It wouldn't be so bad if she were to be put to torment at once, but that isn't to be. It may be years. It may be never."
"You believe she may be released, Master?"
"She's a pawn in the Autarch's game with Vodalus. Even I know that much. Her sister, the Chatelaine Thea, has fled the House Absolute to become his leman. They will bargain with Thecla for a time at least, and while they do, we must give her good fare, yet not too good."
"I see," I said. I was acutely uncomfortable not knowing what the Chatelaine Thecla had told Draught, and what Draught had told Master Gerloz.
"She's asked for better food, and I've made arrangements to supply it. She's asked for company as well. And when we told her visitors would not be permitted, she urged that one of us, at least, should keep her company sometimes."
Master Gerloz paused to wipe his shining face with the edge of his cloak. I said I understand. I was fairly certain that I indeed understood what was to come next.
"Because she had seen your face, she asked for you. I told her you'll sit with her while she eats. I don't ask your agreement, not only because you're subject to my instructions, but because I know you're loyal. What I do ask is that you be careful not to displease her, and not to please her too much."
"I will do my best." I was surprised to hear my own steady voice. Master Gerloz smiled as if I had eased him.
"You have a good head, Severian, though it's a young one yet. Have you been with a woman?"
When we apprentices talked, it was the custom to invent fables on this topic. But I was not among apprentices now, and I shook my head.
"You've never been to the witches?" "That may be for the best. They supplied my own instruction in the warm commerce, but I'm not sure I'd send them another such as I was. It's likely, though, that the Chatelaine wants her bed warmed."
"You're not to do it for her. Her pregnancy would be no ordinary one. It might force a delay in her torment and bring disgrace on the guild. You follow me?"
I nodded.
"Boys your age are troubled.
I'll have somebody take you where such ills are speedily cured."
"As you wish, Master."
"What? You don't thank me?"
"Thank you, Master," I said. Gerloz was one of the most complex men I have known, because he was a complex man trying to be simple. Not a simple, but a complex man's idea of simplicity. Just as a courtier forms himself into something brilliant and involved midway between a dancing master and a diplomacist, with a touch of assassin if needed. So Master Gerlose had shaped himself to be the dull creature a pursuivant or bailiff expected to see when he summoned the head of our guild. And that is the only thing a real torturer cannot be. The strain showed. Though every part of Gerlose was as it should have been, none of the parts fit. He drank heavily and suffered from nightmares, but he had the nightmares when he had been drinking, as if the wine, instead of bolting the doors of his mind, threw them open and left him staggering about in the last hours of the night, trying to catch a glimpse of a sun that had not yet appeared. A sun that would banish the phantoms from his big cabin and permit him to dress and send the journeymen to their business. Sometimes he went to the top of our tower, above the guns, and waited there talking to himself, peering through glass, said to be harder than flint, for the first beams. He was the only one in our guild, Master Palaemon not excepted, who was unafraid of the energies there, and the unseen mouths that spoke sometimes to human beings and sometimes to other mouths in other towers and keeps. He loved music, but he thumped the arm of his chair to it and tapped his foot, and did so most vigorously to the kind he liked best, whose rhythms were too subtle for any regular cadence. He ate too much and too seldom, read when he thought no one knew of it, and visited certain of our clients, including one on the third level, to talk of things none of us, eavesdropping in the corridor outside, could understand. His eyes were refulgent, brighter than any woman's. He mispronounced quite common words, urticate, salpinks, bordereau. I cannot well tell you how bad he looked when I returned to the Citadel recently. How bad he looks now. Chapter 8. The Conversationalist. Next day, for the first time, I carried Thecla's supper to her. For a watch I remained with her, frequently observed through the slot in the cell door by Draught. We played word games, at which she was far better than I, and after a while talked of those things those who have returned are said to say lie beyond death, she recounting what she had read in the smallest of the books I had brought her, not only the accepted views of the Hierophants, but various eccentric and heretic theories. "When I am free," she said, "I shall found my own sect. I will tell everyone that its wisdom was revealed to me during my sojourn among the torturers. They'll listen to that." I asked her what her teachings would be. "That there is no agathodemon or afterlife. That the mind is extinguished in death as in sleep, yet more so." "But who will you say revealed that to you?" She shook her head, then rested her pointed chin upon one hand, a pose that showed off the graceful line of her neck admirably. "I haven't decided yet. An angel of ice, perhaps? Or a ghost? Which do you think best? Isn't there a contradiction in that?" "Precisely." Her voice was rich with the pleasure the question gave her. "In that contradiction will reside the appeal of this new belief. One can't found a novel theology on nothing, and nothing is so secure a foundation as a contradiction. Look at the great successes of the past. They say their deities are the masters of all the universes, and yet that they require grandmothers to defend them, as if they were children frightened by poultry, or that the authority that punishes no one, while there exists a chance for reformation, will punish everyone when there is no possibility anyone will become the better for it." I said, "These things are too complex for me." "No, they're not. You're as intelligent as most young men, I think. But I suppose you torturers have no religion. Do they make you swear to give it up? Not at all. We've a celestial patroness and observances, just like any other guild. We don't, she said. For a moment she seemed to brood on that. Only the guild do, you know, and the army, which is a kind of guild. We'd be better off, I think, if we did. Still, all the days of feast and nights of vigil have become shows. Opportunities to wear new dresses. Do you like this? She stood and extended her arms to show the soiled gown. It's very pretty, I ventured. The embroidery and the way the little pearls are sewed on. It's the only thing I have here. What I was wearing when I was taken. It's for dinner, really. After late afternoon and before early evening. I said I was sure Master Gerloz would have others brought if she asked. I already have, and he says he sent some people to the House Absolute to fetch them for me, but they were unable to find it, which means that the House Absolute is trying to pretend I don't exist. Anyway, it's possible all my clothes have been sent to our chateau in the north, or one of the villas. He's going to have his secretary write them for me. Do you know who he sent? I asked. The House Absolute must be nearly as big as our citadel, and I would think it would be impossible for anyone to miss. On the contrary, it's quite easy. Since it can't be seen, you can be there and never know it if you're not lucky. Besides, with the roads closed, all they have to do is alert their spies to give a particular party incorrect direction, and they have spies everywhere. I started to ask how it was possible for the House Absolute, which I had always imagined a vast palace of gleaming towers and domed halls, to be invisible. But Thecla was already thinking of something else altogether, stroking a bracelet formed like a kraken whose tentacles wrapped the white flesh of her arm. Its eyes were cabochon emeralds. They let me keep this, and it's quite valuable. Platinum, not silver. I was surprised. There's no one here who can be bribed. It might be sold in Nessus to buy clothing. Have any of my friends tried to see me? Do you know, Severian? I shook my head. They would not be admitted. I understand, but someone might try. Do you know that most of the people in the House Absolute don't know this place exists? I see you don't believe me. You mean they don't know of the Citadel? They're aware of that, of course. Parts of it are open to everyone, and anyway, you can't miss seeing the spires if you get down to the southern end of the living city, no matter which side of Guile you're on. She slapped the metal wall of her cell with one hand. They don't know of this. Or at least, a great many of them would deny it still exists. She was a great, great chatelaine. And I was something worse than a slave. I mean in the eyes of the common people, who do not really understand the functions of our guild. Yet when the time had passed and Drott tapped the ringing door, it was I who rose and left the cell and soon climbed into the clean air of evening, and Thecla, who stayed behind to listen to the moans and screams of the others. Though her cell was some distance from the stairwell, the laughter from the third level was audible still when there was no one there to talk with her. In our dormitory that night, I asked if anyone knew the names of the journeymen Master Gerloz had sent in search of the House Absolute. No one did, but my question stirred an animated discussion. Although none of the boys had seen the place, or so much as spoken with anyone who had, all had heard stories. Most were of fabled wealth, gold plates and silk saddle blankets and that sort of thing. More interesting were the descriptions of the Autarch, who would have had to be a kind of monster to fit them all. He was said to be tall when standing, of common size seated, aged, young, a woman,